ready to keep you company wherever you are. Carte Blanche, the podcast, brings you immersive, hard-hitting stories anytime, anywhere, every week.
Welcome to a slightly longer, crime-focused installment of The Whole Week Wrap with Daily Maverick and Carte Blanche. With us this week is Daily Maverick journalist Takudzwa Pongweni. Here's what's coming your way. How a memorandum of understanding can potentially turn the tide against crime in the Western Cape. Then, no one is safe from extortion rackets, not even schools.
If this is already happening in Eastern Cape schools and hospitals, the chances of it spreading to other provinces are quite high. So now that they know this, they should be on the ground trying to counter it before it happens.
Later, why are food poisoning incidents on the rise? And how one man turned personal tragedy into triumph for hundreds of disabled children nationwide. But first, Amapanyaza is here to stay. These were the words of Gauteng Premier Panyaza Lesufi back in June. Despite allegations of inadequate training, abuses of power, and a questionable vetting process, Lesufi is not willing to let go of his beloved crime prevention unit.
Takudzwa, it feels like we haven't had you on the show in ages. How have you been doing?
I'm good. I'm feeling much better now that I'm here. I've missed speaking to you and also the listeners.
Lovely. No, it's always great having you. Now, this week's show has a strong crime focus since we'll be touching on a number of issues really relating to South Africa's ongoing fight against crime. I want us to kick things off in Gauteng, which is kind of your area of expertise. And let's look at the continuing drama around Gauteng Premier Panyaza Lesufi's crime prevention wardens, or Amapanyaza. You've been following this story for months now, having reported on the alleged lackluster training of the wardens and now seemingly flawed vetting processes, which is really very concerning. So tell us a little bit more about what the latest is in this mess of a crime fighting operation.
Crime prevention wardens are constantly in the headlines for all the wrong reasons. The latest is that earlier this year, the Premier announced that he's recruiting military veterans to join the program. He labeled them as the generation that will end lawlessness in the province. He's given addresses saying, "You've liberated this country before. I'm calling on you to liberate it again." When he made these announcements, it was earlier on in the year, around February, and a lot of people were a bit skeptical about this, you know, questioned if this is an election ploy, how effective could military veterans be. But as Panyaza frequently does, he just steamed ahead with it. And right now, I believe over 2,500 military veterans have received training, and now they are currently operating as crime prevention wardens. But there's been some troubling concerns that have emerged about the integrity of the recruitment process. There's allegations of widespread corruption and misrepresentation, with allegations that many of the people who are in this program and who are being touted out as military veterans are actually, in fact, lack genuine military experience and background.
And in terms of this process, because what concerns me is that in the past, we've already heard of many reports of alleged abuses of power. We've reported on that as well on our show, and I know you've written about it. And surely, if the vetting process is failing, then how do you know you have reliable, safe people out there forming part of this unit? How do you know they are above board?
That's the thing. We don't know. And it's concerning. These are people who are tasked with reducing crime, helping communities be even safer. But now if they've misrepresented their credentials, it just contributes to the problem. On top of that, if they haven't had any experience whatsoever, I don't know how effective the training was to enable them to be going out there and actually making a positive difference. And you're right about allegations of abuse of power. It's a real concern. Everyone wants something to be done about crime in the province, but you don't just want random people running around doing as they please. You want people who have been vetted thoroughly, who have gone through proper training, and you want whatever program is being initiated to tackle crime to stand up against research. You know, is the best way of tackling the crime issue in Gauteng deploying military veterans? You know, that's another question.
Yes. And I mean, they've undergone training under the SANDF. They have pretty much full police powers. So my question is, has this unit had any real impact since it was launched? Have we seen any real positive impact from this unit on the street?
I don't think we have. There hasn't been a significant change in safety levels in Gauteng since the introduction of these wardens. As I said, they're just constantly in the headlines for all the wrong reasons. Abuses of power by them. In August last year, there was an incident where they brutally assaulted a young man. Also, sometime last year, they've been given BMWs to drive around. And I think over 22 of them have already been damaged significantly in car accidents. So
yes,
it seems like there's very little crime fighting that's going on.
Now, just to wrap up this part of the conversation, do you have any idea why Panyaza is so determined to have this unit, even though everything is pointing towards this unit not really working?
I think crime, it's a very emotive subject, and I think it's easy to really rile people up about it. And people are quite desperate to see a change. So at this point, it's almost like any initiative is welcome. And he's very quick to say, yes, you might be reading these negative headlines about a select amount of our wardens, but the vast majority of it is going really well. I don't know. Maybe it's an optics thing. They're nicknamed Amapanyaza because they're his brainchild. They wear green and everyone just knows the crime prevention wardens and immediately associates them with him. Maybe it's an ego type of thing. Maybe he's just truly in denial and he doesn't see the extent of the concerns and damages that's occurring.
The stats are in and the Western Cape is drowning. This after several of the province's police stations once again ranked among the highest when it came to reported crime. The solution? A policing memorandum of understanding. So, could this agreement lead to actual progress in the fight against gang violence, mafia-like activities, and the deeply rooted criminal underworld?
Now, let's shift our focus to the Western Cape, and the latest crime stats from January to June this year really paints a truly horrible picture of how various criminal figures are essentially holding the Western Cape province to ransom. We've seen an over 20% jump in murders, while some regions have seen between 40 and 76% spikes in their violent crime incidents. Now, in an attempt to get a handle on this worsening crime spree, we saw the Western Cape government, the City of Cape Town, and the national government sign a memorandum of understanding, or an MOU. What do you make of this MOU agreement? And do you think it's more than just some symbolic gesture? Or do you think, again, speaking of optics, do you think this is just optics? What do you make of this?
I'm hopeful that it's not just lip service and that actually something happens from this. Some of the key objectives of the agreement to combat crime, it's to increase police presence, boost the number of police officers deployed in high crime areas to enhance visibility and deterrence. They want to increase their use of technology and resources, enhance the effectiveness of crime fighting efforts through the integration and utilization of advanced technology, surveillance system, data analytics, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Also improved intelligence gathering and analysis, something that policing experts have pointed out as a weakness in how South Africa approaches policing. There's some issues in our intelligence gathering methods there. I think what will be key is having a structured and targeted approach to crime reduction with clear goals and accountability so that we can look back in 3 months' time and say, this is what was promised and here's the tracking of what's going on.
And I'm sure some of our listeners are probably sitting thinking, what's the big deal? I mean, it's just another agreement that's been signed. It's just more paper. But historically, I think within the Western Cape, this is actually quite a big step for them because there's always been some level of animosity between the city and the province and national government when it comes to really who has actual control over crime fighting efforts in the province. So this memorandum really aims to ensure a more cohesive approach. And I think that's why this is a big deal, because now I think they will be speaking from the same place, because it's really difficult to tackle issues such as gang violence and extortion rackets if everyone's kind of trying to do their own thing. So it's very important for everyone to be on the same page. And I think that's maybe what sets this apart from previous agreements that have been made between government officials.
The Western Cape has long struggled with high levels of gang violence and related criminal activities. And you're right in that there seems to be sort of a tussle between who's doing what. I think a really good example of that is the Western Cape also have their own version of crime prevention wardens. They're known as LEAP. So LEAP was launched without explicit parliamentary authorization because they involve or intend to involve the deployment of armed personnel. And it raises some questions about the constitution and what it says about armed organizations or services being established. But how LEAP differs and works well is that it's got financial support from the Western Cape provincial government, and it's been able to supplement SAPs to increase their capacity in areas with high murder rates. Another distinction between them is that their training process, their recruitment process, it seemed a lot more thought out and carefully staged. So there's a bit more optimism in terms of what LEAP is doing. But definitely having all these initiatives coming together with one aim of tackling crime, I think that's probably one of the best ways to go about it. Far too often we're doing things in silos when we're all trying to achieve the same goal, which is a safer South Africa.
Whether it's paying for your safety, paying to use a specific taxi or bus route, or shelling out the cash to ensure your project isn't brought to a standstill by the construction mafia. Extortion rackets are far too common, and judging by reports coming from the Eastern Cape, only getting worse. Does government have the know-how to prevent protection rackets from taking hold across South Africa?
Speaking of extortion rackets, it's an issue Carte Blanche has reported on extensively in recent months. Our focus has been primarily on the Western Cape. We did a very eye-opening story on the extortion rackets down Long Street in Cape Town. We also visited residents in Khayelitsha, where even street vendors and churches are now forced to pay protection fees. I know Daily Maverick's Karen Dolly has done a lot of reporting on this as well. And that's where the focus has been in terms of the extortion rackets. But it's not only limited to just the Western Cape. It's now shown its teeth in the Eastern Cape. In a particularly worrying way, we've seen these extortion syndicates now targeting schools, which is just mind-boggling to me. And I'm just wondering, how did we get to a point where these extortion rackets are now becoming a national trend?
So you're right. Extortion isn't anything new in South Africa, unfortunately. But what's frequently grabbed the headlines is extortion at some large projects and businesses. But the past couple of weeks, we're seeing that it's permeating all sectors of society. We have reports of extortion happening at church services, funeral parlors saying that they've been stopped on the roads and forced to pay a fee, family-related events, pensions, healthcare facilities, and schools. I think the school one, all of it is very concerning. But I think the school one is, for me, it's personally the most concerning. It leads to disruptions in academic activities. Now there's increased security costs and financial burdens. It undermines the quality of education, but it creates this environment of fear and instability for students and staff.
While I was reading up on this, I read about one specific, really horrific incident highlighted by Basic Education Minister Siviwe Gwahube. She spoke of the school for the blind in the Eastern Cape that was targeted by extortionists. They stormed the school and they demanded 50,000 rands from school staff. The staff obviously said, no, there's no way we're paying this. But they now started issuing threats saying, if you don't pay up, we're going to attack the schools. So it's just so concerning. And something, as you've just said, where it was previously just kind of aimed towards businesses, now you have schools. So my question then is, where do you start? What do you do to eradicate these extortion rackets when it feels like this is just another trend and we're just going to have to get used to it, it seems?
I've heard from some policing experts that South Africa continues to rely heavily on reactive policing methods, which involves responding to crimes and emergencies after they've already occurred. This approach is largely due to the inadequacy of current intelligence services, which are essential for proactively identifying and addressing potential criminal activities before they escalate. Mm-hmm. So maybe what we need is just an overhaul of our policing approach, just smarter policing. Smarter policing involves adopting strategies that anticipate and prevent criminal activities before they occur. So things like using data analytics to identify crime trends, predict potential mm-hmm. hotspots, deploy resources strategically. You know, if this is already happening in Eastern Cape schools and hospitals, the chances of it spreading to other provinces are quite high. So now that they know this, they should be on the ground trying to counter it before it happens.
On Wednesday, the 4th of September, anti-crime leader Mandla Nkambule was killed in an apparent hit. Having founded the crime-fighting organization Tata Zonke in Ekurhuleni, he was both loved and hated by many.
Now, I want us to wrap up our crime focus with some sad news regarding one individual who really took it upon himself to fight crime in his community. In June last year, Carte Blanche's Claire Mawisa sat down with Mandla Nkambule. He's the leader of Tata Zonke, an anti-crime unit in Ekurhuleni. And late last week, it was confirmed that Nkambule was killed in an apparent hit. We've been told that the community is really reeling following his death, with many concerned that the crime will unfortunately once again just take hold in the area. I understand, you know, also that the whole Tata Zonke thing was controversial when we initially did the story on them. Some called it a glorified vigilante movement. But I think what we need to take away from this is that regardless of which side of the debate you're on, it's really sad when we do lose individuals like Nkambule who are willingly putting their lives on the line to make their communities better, make South Africa better. It's really a sad day whenever we lose someone like that.
Absolutely. And not to endorse vigilantism or anything, but we wouldn't be having these groups if our policing system was effective. Ordinary citizens wouldn't feel it necessary to take it upon themselves to deal with this. But the community is absolutely reeling. He was known in and around as really caring about just having a safer Gauteng. He was attached to many other community anti-crime units in the province. He just wanted to do things by the book, observe the law. He wanted everyone to work under the law. He wanted everyone to have just a safe and just as be able to walk the streets of Gauteng safely. So I think it's quite upsetting that he died at the hands of something he was working so hard to prevent. And no matter where you stand on it, the loss of life is tragic regardless. And I feel for his family, his friends, his co-workers, and the community itself.
Food safety is often something we take for granted. You buy your favorite items, prepare them, and enjoy them. But Gauteng government is sounding the alarm following a dramatic spike in reported food poisoning cases, especially in informal settlements. So, what's driving this increase? Takudzwa explains.
So let's move on to another story that you have been following. For some of our listeners, they would have seen that this past Sunday we had a follow-up story on the devastating listeriosis outbreak that left over 200 South Africans dead. And you wrote a somewhat related story on the increase in food poisoning cases seen in children in especially informal settlements and hostels. I read in your article that it's gotten so bad now that the Gauteng Department of Health has actually issued an urgent warning about these poisonings. So tell us a little bit more about this.
Since February 2024, Gauteng has reported a staggering amount of cases. I think it's 207 food poisoning cases among children, with 10 resulting, unfortunately, in fatalities. The Ekurhuleni district is the hardest hit. It's recorded 119 cases with 4 deaths. Johannesburg has 40 cases, Pretoria has 31 and 3 deaths, and West Rand has 14 cases. So it's quite a large number. I think it's particularly concerning because these are children, and it underscores the high risk faced by children living in poorer conditions because they're more likely to be exposed to such things.
And what's the main reason for this spike in food poisoning incidents?
I believe the department is still in the process of conducting investigation to get to the root cause. But in the meantime, they've stressed that basic principles of food safety need to be adhered to at all times. But I think particularly in this case, because of the children that it's affecting, it's to do with the dangers of fake foods that are sold in unregulated spaza shops. So fake food encompasses a range of deceptive practices, including mislabeling or counterfeiting of food products. It's driven by these money-hungry individuals who are seeking financial gain at the expense of consumer well-being. And some examples of fake foods include diluted or contaminated beverages, counterfeit beverages, counterfeit spices, and falsely labeled expired or low-quality food items. And the reason I say it's particularly important in this case is that the vast majority of these children who have been affected are in informal settlements. And it's in these areas where you have spaza shops. And spaza shops are wonderful. They provide convenience and accessibilities to township and rural communities. But the issue is they often lack proper oversight and regulation, which creates an environment where unethical shop owners may take advantage of lax monitoring and sell fake food without consequences. So it's a cause for concern.
We've recently done a story as well on counterfeit goods, not so much the food aspect, but during our raid, we saw that literally anything is apt to be a fake product these days. We even found fake medication. So, I mean, it's really, really dangerous. And I think that is definitely an avenue that the department needs to investigate because I think it's rife throughout a lot of the communities in South Africa where these spaza shops and these informal retailers just kind of sell cheap stuff for maximum profit. And they really, as you said, they don't really care about the human impact that it has at the end of the day.
I spoke to a food safety expert who said he doesn't think the issue is a lack of regulations in the country. The regulations are in place, but the issue seems to be the implementation of it. An example of this is that we have a regulation called R638 of 2018 for food premises, and it highlights the standards for maintaining hygiene and food safety in establishments such as spaza shops. The regulation mandates regular inspections and requires environmental health practitioners to enforce these standards, offer guidance to shop owners, address violations, including the sale of these fake foods. But unfortunately, compliance with this requirement is not consistently enforced by municipal inspectors before they issue food trading permits or certificates of accessibility. So that's a cause for concern. You know, there's no accountability or oversight measure in place. And unfortunately, townships often receive inadequate inspection attention. And it's widely acknowledged that spaza shops in this area, they present significant risk. So hopefully in the coming weeks, the department start having talks about a strategy or a proactive approach to look into these shops that are affecting these communities and how to tackle them, because these are some of our most vulnerable community members.
There's a Tibetan saying, tragedy should be utilized as a source of strength. In Nico Grobler's case, he used personal tragedy to change young lives, one DIY walking frame at a time.
Let's move on to some good news. I think after all of this, it's needed. And this is such an inspirational story that I just happened to come across. It was originally covered by Huisgenoot, and I felt we just need to discuss this because it's just such a lovely story. It's about a dad, Nico Grobler, who has taken it upon himself to provide much needed walking frames to hundreds of disabled children across the country. This comes after his own child Jaden was in terrible accident and was left unable to walk or talk, and he had to buy a walking frame for his son. And he realized these frames are quite expensive, but he was lucky enough to be able to afford it. But he realized that for many families out there, this relatively simple device is just far too expensive for them. So he decided to make his own walking frames, and he's making these walking frames freely available to those in need. And I just think it's such an amazing story. It's beautiful because a lot of the times the disabled communities are really overlooked in South Africa. So I was very, very happy to see someone stepping up and just doing the most.
Absolutely. I think he took the words right out of my mouth. It was one of the best stories I read in the past week. Most children with disabilities require care beyond what parents or primary caregivers can provide. Especially in South Africa, the healthcare system faces significant challenges related to accessibility and affordability. The public health care system is often strained. Private options are just completely unaffordable. And there's also the geographical limitations. Sometimes in rural areas or lower income communities, they may have fewer resources and services available to support children that have disabilities. Hmm. This story, though, I thought it was beautiful. He was able to transform his personal tragedy into a force for good, and it's a good that benefits hundreds of children, which I thought it was beautiful. You know, instead of being overwhelmed by his son's condition, or just, he's in a fortunate enough position where he could afford a walker for his son, and he could have just left it at that, you know, but he took it upon himself to help others, and I thought that was beautiful. He had this empathy that drove him to address a pressing need that he had first-hand knowledge of.
Yes, and what I love is that he's drawing other people into this project now. So it's growing, and I'm just very excited to see what comes from it in the coming years, because I'm certain it will literally save and change so many lives if this continues. So yeah, this makes me very happy. It makes me proud of South Africans who just step up and really give whatever they can to make a difference. And that's really the point of our green shoots at the end of each episode. It's just so that you walk away feeling a little bit more inspired, a little bit more hopeful. And yeah, I hope this story does that for our listeners this week.
I hope it will too, and just serve as a reminder of what can be achieved with community support and partnerships. You know, they've been able to pull diverse resources, skills, expertise, all these people in order to create these affordable walking frames and solutions. So I thought that was beautiful. I really like the story. I think it highlights two characteristics that are frequently associated with South Africans, and that's resilience and hope, transforming personal tragedy into action underscores the resilience of the human spirit. It reflects the ability to overcome adversity and just be positive for a change. And I think that's beautiful. It showed that even in the darkest of times, there is potential for hope.
Beautiful, beautiful words. That's unfortunately all we have time for in this week's installment of the Whole Week Wrap. And we've covered a lot, and we've gone all over the country, which is fantastic. Tukuzwa, thanks so much for bringing your insights and for joining us again for a great chat. It's been great having you on the show again.
Lovely to be here. I hope we don't take a longer gap next time.
Definitely. Wishing you a lovely week further.
You too.
Thanks for listening. Catch us again next week for another Whole Week Wrap. Until then, why not join the conversation on Twitter, Facebook, and everywhere else? We always love hearing from you.